Article 5 by the state level.
Thank you. I'd like to call this meeting the State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 23rd in capital city of Juneau. Present today are Vice Chair Kleiman, Senators Merrick, Wilkowski, Bjorkman, myself, Chair Kawasaki. Before we start, please silence your cell phones. I'd like to remind members and testifiers that all questions and comments must be directed through the chair. And before testifying, please clearly state your name, your title, and your affiliation for the record. With us today from Senate Records is Carrie Cooper-Reiner. Thank you for being here. And James Wade is our moderator with the Legislative Information Office. On today's agenda, we have three bills to hear today. We have an act established. We have an act relating to the selection, retention, and rejection of judicial officers for the Court of Appeals, District Court and Magistrates, relating to the duties of Judicial Council and relating to the duties of the Commission of Judicial Conduct. We have Senate Bill 32, an act, I'm sorry, that Senate Bill 31 is sponsored by Senator Schauer. We have Senate Bill 32, an act prohibiting the use of chokeholds by peace officers and relating to justification of the use of force by peace officers. We have Senate Bill 28 relating to workplace violence protective orders relating to the crime of violating a protective order, powers and duties of district judges and magistrates, amending Rules 465 civil rules of civil procedures, and providing for an effective date, sponsored by Vice Chair Kleiman. With that, if Senator Kleiman and his staff, Ms. Lizzie Kubitz, would like to present Senate Bill 28. We also have a couple folks in the room who may testify or be here for questions. Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Alaska Court System. Captain Cornelius Sims, the Alaska State Troopers via teleconference, I believe. And Lisa Purinton, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief from the Department of Public Safety. With that, Senator Kleiman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the state. For the Senate State Affairs Committee, for the record, I'm Matt Kleiman, Senator for West Anchorage District H. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 28. A member of the legal community contacted our office about a situation where a former employee made a credible threat that he intended to go into the employer's worksite and shoot as many people as he could. When the attorney representing the employer tried to obtain a restraining order, she realized that to protect the employer, she would need to file a civil lawsuit and then file a separate motion asking for a temporary restraining order. The process took several days to complete and obtain the order. In contrast, people seeking a domestic violence restraining order can usually get the court order within one day, sometimes a matter of hours. Senate Bill 28, modeled after Alaska's domestic violence protective order process, allows an employer to file a petition for a protective order against an individual who the employer reasonably believes committed an act of violence against the employer or an employee, or made a threat of violence against the employer or an employee that can reasonably be construed as a threat that may be carried out at the employer's workplace. A violation of the provisions of the protective order would be the crime of violating a protective order, which is a Class A misdemeanor. The intent of Senate Bill 28 is to help prevent incidents such as the fatal shooting of a hospital employee by an ex-employee at the Soldotna Central Peninsula General Hospital in November 2008. 8 states have laws providing for the issuance of workplace restraining orders, and 3 states have the option for employers to file the same type of orders that are available to victims. Several other states are currently considering related legislation. Senate Bill 28 gives employers a more effective way to protect their workplace and their employees from threats of violence. And with that, I will turn over to my staff, Lizzie Kubitz, to explain the details of the bill.
Welcome, Ms. Kubitz. For the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Senator Kleiman. As Senator Kleiman stated, Senate Bill 28 creates a new type of protective order, a workplace violence protective order. Section 1 amends AS 1156-740A by adding a new subsection 4 to specify that a person commits the crime of violating a protective order if the person knowingly commits or attempts to commit an act that violates the provisions listed under the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes. Section 2 amends AS 1156-740C by adding the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes to the meaning of protective order. Section 3 amends AS 1865-530A by clarifying that the mandatory arrest statute for crimes involving domestic violence, violation of protective orders, and violation of conditions of release is subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 1865-540A to add the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes to the Central Registry of Protective Orders maintained by the Department of Public Safety. Section 5 amends AS 1865-540B to add the Workplace Violence Protective Order statutes to the list of protective orders a peace officer enters into the Central Registry within 24 hours of receiving. Section 6 amends AS 1865 to add new section, Article 12A, Workplace Violence Protective Orders. And all of these next sections relate to what we're intending to do with Senate Bill 28. Section 1865-875A gives employers the ability to file a petition for a protective order against an individual who the employer reasonably believes, one, committed an act of violence against the employer or an employee, or two, made a threat of violence against the employer or an employee that can reasonably be construed as a threat that may be carried out at the employer's workplace. Section B specifies that the court shall schedule a hearing and provide at least 10 days notice to the respondent. Section C details prohibited behavior of the respondent after the protective order is issued. Section D describes the court's responsibilities related to issuing a protective order. Section E clarifies a court may not deny a petition for a protective order solely because of a lapse of time between an act of violence or a threat of violence and filing of the petition. Section 1865-877 gives employers the ability to file a petition for an ex parte protective order, a temporary order that would grant immediate protection. Section 1865-880 creates a process for either the petitioner or the respondent to request modification of a protective order. Section 1865-885 specifies that an invitation by the petitioner or a named designated employee of the petitioner to communicate with the petitioner or to be present at or enter the workplace, residence, vehicle, or other place does not in any way invalidate or nullify the protective order. Section 1865-890 clarifies that the court system will prepare forms for petitions, protective orders, and instructions for their use by an employer seeking a protective order. Section 1865-895 clarifies that protective orders should be promptly served and executed. Section 1865-897 creates civil liability provisions. Section 1865-899 makes the definitions of course of conduct, employee, employer, threat of violence, violence, and workplace apply to the workplace violence protective order statutes. Section 7 amends AS 2215-100 subsection 9 by adding a new section C to give district judges and magistrates the power to issue a protective order in cases involving workplace violence. Section 8 relates to indirect court rule amendments. It specifies amendments to Rule 4, Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure, and Rule 9, Alaska Rules of Administration, relating to fees and service of process for a workplace violence protective order, and Rule 65, Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure, by changing the method for obtaining and the timing of temporary restraining orders. Section 9 relates to applicability. It makes Section 8 conditional on approval by the two-thirds majority vote of each House required by Article 4, Section 15 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And finally, Section 10 provides for an effective date. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff at this point? Okay. Let me take a really brief at ease. on the record. We're back on the record. Thank you. It looks like we have a couple people that are online who might be able to answer questions if there's any folks that have questions. And also in the room, we have Captain Cornelius Sims from the Alaska State Troopers, who's online, Lisa Purinton from Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief from the Department of Public Safety, who's in person. We also have Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. If there's any questions for those three, or if anyone has any prepared statement at this time for the Senate bill. Okay, and I'll go ahead and open up public testimony on this bill. Let's see. Okay, let's see. Do we have anybody who is here to testify on Senate Bill 28 at this time? You want to? Okay. Looks like, let's see. We do have public testimony. So if you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Brenda Stanfill with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for having the opportunity to address Senate Bill 28 today. One of the things that we have heard a lot from our programs in our, especially some of our rural communities, that oftentimes there is a fear of somebody who is maybe standing right outside of their property and who is very upset at the agency. Oftentimes our member programs are our victim service providers, and oftentimes there's someone upset at them. And we had thought for a long time, well, you know, you can just get a trespassing order and then somebody can't come on. And they pointed out, our rural programs pointed out, well, that doesn't really help us if they're standing outside off of our property and they're not violating any crime. Nobody's going to come out and respond in this way. And so this is one mechanism that can help them to be able to protect themselves and their staff. And so that's just one way that this could be used. Senator Klayman talked about some of the fear that people go through with a threat being made at their workplace. And then we're also working with Senator Klayman to make sure that we don't get in a situation where somebody wants to help a domestic violence victim and may request a restraining order on their behalf. And so a little bit of work we're doing just on some wordsmithing on that, but we are very supportive of having a mechanism in place where our workplaces can protect themselves. So thank you for introducing this and for allowing me the opportunity to speak to it.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Stanfill. Are there any questions for Ms. Stanfill? Seeing none, at this time we'll close public testimony. And so that'll conclude our public testimony and invited testimony for today's. Is there any committee discussion before we set this bill aside and move on to the next bill? You have any questions? Anything to say? That's good. Okay, at this time we'll set Senate Bill 28 aside and we'll take a brief at ease so the next person can queue up. All right, I'll reconvene this meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Next, we have Senate Bill 32. Senate Bill 32 is by Senator L.B. Gray Jackson. And we have the senator here, along with Ms. Bessie Odom, to present the bill. Thank you for being here. And if you want to go ahead and start.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Elby Gray Jackson, first I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and your committee members for hearing my bill in such a timely manner.
Thank you.
First, I want to thank all the hardworking peace officers and office staff who provide the services that protect the lives and welfare of the people within Alaska communities. Thank you all for your service. Casualties surrounding civilians across the country and, unfortunately, within Alaska has drawn even greater attention to issues around policing and police-to-community relationships. This moment seems to have created real momentum to address one of the longest-standing injustices within society. In 2020, my office, along with former Senator Begich's office, worked together to develop a series of bills. These bills were drafted by Legislative Legal as a bill packet that our offices refer to as TPIP, Turning Pain into Progress. TPIP was crafted after the National Aid Can't Wait campaign, which is eight specific policies that have been proven with data to reduce police violence by as much as 72% when implemented. We recognize that the national campaign can't and shouldn't be applied to a place as unique as Alaska. Therefore, a great deal of time was spent talking with stakeholders and gaining input throughout the process of drafting these bills and gaining bills to ensure that the proposals would be fitting for Alaska. We engaged public safety agencies to include the Anchorage Police Department, Anchorage Police Employees Association, Public Safety Employees Association, and the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives during this process. Because of a proactive approach, we were confident in moving forward with the implementation of public safety policy changes that will benefit both the citizens of Alaska and our law enforcement officers. During the second session of the 32nd legislature, Senate Bill 7, requiring the Department of Public Safety to publish certain policies and procedures on their website, was signed into law on July 28, 2022. Of the six bills presented, I was honored to see one move forward. During this session, I introduced only two of the remaining five, of which one was Senate Bill 32, which prohibits show calls. That's the one that's being presented today, Mr. Chairman. Police use numerous methods to restrain and limit the movement and overall activity of someone who possesses a danger to themselves and to others, including the police officer. One of the most common restraints are carotid and tracheal choke. Both restraints impede the breathing and circulation of blood. If these restraints are used incorrectly, death through asphyxiation may occur. Throughout the United States, there are cases of the misuse of chokeholds. Senate Bill 32 would assist in reducing the rate of chokeholds and use incorrectly. Senate Bill 32 would further seek to improve community relationships by addressing a long-standing issue around the use of force. With that said, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'd like to introduce my Chief of Staff, Bessie Odom, who will read a sectional analysis and present a really brief PowerPoint presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elby Gray Jackson. We have Ms. Odom. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, Bessie Odom, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. Section 1 for the sectional analysis for SB 32. The second amends AS 1181-370. The statute regarding use of force by a peace officer in making an arrest or terminating an escape by adding a new subsection that would prohibit the use of potentially lethal restraints.
Thank you, Ms. Odom. Are there questions of the sponsor of the bill or Ms. Odom? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki, and thank you, Senator Gray Jackson, for bringing this bill forward. Do you know how many law enforcement agencies in the state still allow the use of chokeholds?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, no, I don't know, but I do know that it is currently prohibited by the Anchorage Police Department. But even with that said, like you just mentioned, there may be others where it's not prohibited, and that is one of the reasons why I'm bringing this bill forward. Thank you, Senator Merrick.
Thank you.
I guess I have a question, Ms. Gray Jackson. We did have a different bill relating to the term peace officers. Is the term peace officer to include things like village public safety officers and even correctional officers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Odom, do you have a comment to make?
I do not, but if for the record, this is Bessie Odom. I do not have an additional statement to make, but if you're ready, I can do the PowerPoint here.
Oh, yes. Yeah, please continue. Thank you.
All right. As mentioned before, we drafted this legislation after the national Eight Can't Wait campaign. And the campaign includes such legislation as bans the use of chokeholds and strangleholds, requires de-escalation, requires warning before shooting, requires exhausting all alternatives before shooting, the duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, require a use of force continuum, and require comprehensive reporting. As was mentioned before, we recognize that the national campaign wouldn't fit the unique needs of Alaska, so we worked with various stakeholders such as PSEA, APD, and others to create a bill that truly encompassed the unique needs of our state. I mentioned just moments ago some of these stakeholders that we met with. Additionally, we met with NOBLE, which is the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, APDEA, which is Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, APD, of course, which is Anchorage Police Department, and PSEA, which is the Public Safety Employees Association. This is also to mention that we met with community members as well from varying organizations. And hopefully one of those organizations will be represented through invited testimony here today. So the objective of the bill, of course, prohibits peace officers from knowingly using a restraint that impedes another person's breathing or blood circulation that would likely cause a loss of consciousness. This includes carotid restraints, tracheal chokes, and others that result in the affirmation conditions. Chokeholds are permitted in situations where deadly force is authorized by law. Here we have some photos to explain what each of these chokeholds look like. I think it's worth mentioning that if done incorrectly can result in death. And there we have a statistic to show how many police departments prohibit the following. So you have 71% of police agencies that prohibit chokeholds, 68 prohibit carotid holds. What we know about the ban on chokeholds, a post survey of the 65 largest U.S. police departments found that 46 prohibit chokeholds and their use of force policies, while 44 prohibit carotid holds and those policies. You have Connecticut, California, Florida, New York, Washington, Texas, Illinois, Colorado, Arizona, Delaware, and Iowa. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Odom. Do we have any questions after that presentation? Okay, we're going to open up some public testimony, public and invited testimony at this time. We first have the committee has invited Michael Patterson from the Party for Socialism and Liberation, I believe, and I believe he's online. Mr. Patterson, are you there?
Yeah, yes, I am.
If you'd state your name and your affiliation for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Patterson. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm here today representing the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And I really want to thank the chair and the rest of the committee members for taking up Senate Bill 32 so quickly. I was pretty excited to hear that there was already a committee meeting for it. And also, I'd like to take this time to thank Senator Gray Jackson for really being a leader on these issues and being so consistent about it. And I really want to thank her and her staff for doing what they do, because this is a very important issue. And I think especially since 2020, with the George Floyd uprising, you know, it's nice to have somebody, you know, really take this up. So I just want to begin. I'm speaking as a community organizer who has been working on police reform and police accountability and transparency for the last 3 years. You know, I really want to start by saying I just want the members of the committee to really think about. I think when you talk about statutes and codifying things in the law, I think a lot of times it gets lost in abstraction. But I want people to really think about what does it mean to actually be choked or strangled, to have the blood cut off to your brain and you pass out and you black out, and, or to have your trachea impeded so that you cannot get oxygen to your lungs. Choking somebody or strangling somebody is a very violent act. I'm a combat vet. I served in the Army. I've done things like MMA, and I wrestled in high school. And, you know, I have been choked and strangled through for training and stuff like that. And it is very scary. Even in a controlled situation, passing out or being choked induces a very primal instinct of you think you're going to die. You're like, this person is strangling me. I'm going to die. I have to fight back. I have to do something. And I think if you take it to a next level of now, there's a state actor, i.e. a state trooper or an Anchorage Police Department officer, you know, who is trying to employ a carotid choke or a tracheal choke, even though they're prohibited, it takes it to a whole different level. And I think, you know, as Ms. Odom had previously mentioned, a lot of states following 2020 have already taken up, or they've either had a very similar restrictions or limitations that Senator Gray Jackson is bringing forward with Senate Bill 32, or they've just outright banned chokeholds. And I think it should also be mentioned, too, that, you know, even with training, proper training, and having where officers are trained on how to use this stuff, it is in an actual real-life situation in which somebody has to deploy a chokehold as a measure to get compliance. It's essentially a street fight, and a blood choke can very easily turn to an air choke, and you can permanently injure somebody or you can kill them. And I think one of the other things that has to be mentioned is that just with strangulation as a form of control and compliance is not anything new in the United States. You know, I myself am an African-American man, and I can't have this conversation or even really think about chokehold strangulations without thinking about folks like Eric Garner or George Floyd. But even going back further, thinking about, you know, my ancestors and being lynched and being strangled to control the whole community. And that is something I don't really hear brought up a lot. And so, you know, with Senate Bill 32, one, I think it modernizes Alaska's law. Two, like Senator Gray Jackson had mentioned, I really think codifying Senate Bill 32 in law is really going to show the community and the people of Alaska as a whole that the state is taking accountability and transparency very seriously, and that just doing something as small as codifying this into law, I think we'll do leaps and bounds to make sure that the community can at least regain some trust and faith in a law enforcement in Alaska. And I know a lot of times you hear, oh, Alaska's different. You know, people don't have the same opinions of law enforcement in Alaska. And that simply is just not true. For myself, my first real interaction with APD was when I was 15, and they suspected that I had been involved in a hit and run. And they asked me for my identification, which I was complying with them. I was a kid who was in, you know, Army JRTC. And as I reached to get my wallet, one of the officers pulled out his firearm and pointed it at my head. And I'm 15 years old. And so that has been my entire – that was my first real experience with police here in Anchorage. And so, you know, I don't want to take too much time, but, you know, I really hope that the committee – I really appreciate that this committee taking this bill on so quickly. I really hope this committee moves the bill forward as quickly as possible, you know, and just to summarize, you know, I think making this bill into law is really going to show the communities of Anchorage that have been on the receiving end of police violence and police brutality that the state actually cares. And two, you know, it fundamentally comes down to public and community trust of law enforcement. And for us to have trust in law enforcement, we have to have the ability to have oversight over them. And even though they may already prohibit this stuff, we really do have the right as citizens and residents of Alaska to go through our democratic institutions, such as this committee and the legislature, and codify this prohibition of chokeholds into state law. And I really appreciate the committee's time. You know, and as I said before, please move this bill forward as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Patterson, for your invited testimony. We're going to open up now public testimony. We have several people online, beginning with, it looks like, Daniel Kastner of Fairbanks. If you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record and give us your two-minute testimony.
Yes, my name is Daniel Kastner of Fairbanks. I am speaking today representing myself, and I'm also calling to urge the committee to move this bill forward. I am a combat veteran as well, as the aforementioned Mr. Patterson here, and fact is, chokeholds have no place in peace officer interaction of any kind. They're not particularly effective restraint when it comes down to it. They're not a very effective way to restrain someone compared to others in terms of bodily control. And I believe, as the esteemed senator mentioned, done correctly, they can cause harm and death. And the fact is, the esteemed senator said they can cause harm and death done incorrectly. But the fact is, a carotid shark choke or a tracheal choke can cause death even when done correctly. You're putting someone into a situation where you're depriving their brain of oxygen with the intent of stopping them from moving. And not everyone who's put in one of those wakes up. So not an appropriate solution for physical control, not something that should be in law enforcement toolbox. And I'm urging the committee to move this bill forward. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kastner. Are there questions for Mr. Kastner? Okay, seeing none, we will move, we'll go ahead online and remain online for one more testifier, Cynthia Goshpen from Anchorage, and then we'll take Morgan Lim, who's in the room right now. Cynthia, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can just get 1 second here. Sorry about that.
No problem. If you could just state your name and your affiliation for the record, please.
Hi. So my name is Cynthia Gashin, and I'm with the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm giving testimony today on Senate Bill 32, which is the chokehold ban. I'd like to start off with thanking Senator Gray Jackson for initiating this bill, because this is an issue we should have addressed many years ago. The fact that we still allow this type of brutality to happen within our state by our law enforcement is egregious. Chokeholds have no place within the procedures of our law enforcement. Previous testimony has already touched on the issues and statistics regarding chokeholds, so I won't go too much into those subjects. But I do want to touch on the concerns I have if this bill doesn't move forward. My main concern is that we are trusting that an officer will make the most logical decision while in a state of high adrenaline. We're asking them to walk a fine line between rendering someone unconscious and death. We're trusting that they won't make very human mistakes. I'm not comfortable with that, and you all shouldn't be either. There are many other ways for an officer to restrain suspects without risking the death of that suspect. As a community member and a mother, it doesn't sit right with me that officers are allowed to choose potentially lethal means of restraint when there are many other non-lethal options. I ask that you move Senate Bill 32 forward, and I ask that you consider the community members throughout the state of Alaska and how we feel about this, especially, you know, as I said, I come from a place as a mother. I'm actually doing mother things right now, taking my oldest son to a doctor's appointment, and one of my biggest fears is that as raising a POC son who plans to stay within the state, to go to college in the state, to probably make Alaska his permanent home, that he may one day encounter an officer for, you know, whatever reason, and that I may have to hear that my son didn't make it out that day due to something as minor as a chokehold. That seems to an officer, but really, for someone like me, a mother, could mean the loss of my child. So I just ask you to please consider moving this forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Goshman. Next, we have testimony in the room from Morgan Lim. Morgan would like to stand forward and state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. My name is Morgan Lim. I'm a Juneau resident, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates Alaska. PPAA strongly supports Senate Bill 32, a bill that would limit use of force by peace officers in Alaska. PPAA believes all people should live free from violence and stands with Black, Indigenous, people of color communities as they demand change and seek to create communities that are safe and sustainable. To truly achieve reproductive justice, all people must not only have the right to choose if and when to become parents, but also the right to raise their children in a safe and healthy environment. It is the same over-policing of and violence towards Black and Indigenous bodies in their communities that makes that promise of reproductive freedom unattainable. As our state and country continue to grapple with police brutality, SB 32 takes a step in the right direction towards reducing police use of force. According to Mapping Police Violence Database, Alaska is tragically home to the second highest rate of police killings in the country and has the second highest rate of police violence against Black and Indigenous people. About 1 in 3 people killed by the police is an Alaska Native person, and a Black person in Alaska is 3.3 times more likely to be killed by police as a white person. Additionally, the rates of incarceration in Alaska have grown dramatically in the last several decades, with Black and American Indian and Alaska Native people being incarcerated at 4 to 5 times the rate of white people in Alaska. Approximately 40% of people incarcerated in Alaska identify as American Indian and Alaska Native, despite only making up about 15% of the population. Similarly, 7% of those incarcerated were Black people, despite only making up about 3% of the population. The over-policing of BIPOC communities, the criminalization of BIPOC people, and police violence imposes significant transgenerational trauma directly harming the health of these families and their descendants. We all live in a world where we all deserve to live in a world where we are equally protected and have access to the resources that we need to be healthy, safe, and free from harm. PPAA thanks you for the opportunity to testify on this important piece of legislation, and we urge the committee to move it forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Lim. Are there questions for Mr. Lim? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Let's see. We will now go back off net. We have Amana. I'm not going to be able to pronounce your name, out of Anchorage. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aman Ambise. I'm a social worker and a professor of social work. Thank you all to the members of the committee. I'm calling today to speak in support of Bill SB 32, which bans the use of chokeholds. I also want to express my gratitude and appreciation to Senator Gray Jackson for bringing this bill forward. I think speaking of chokeholds is contradictory to the whole notion of peace. In fact, an oxymoron, if you will, where peace officers have to use chokeholds. I think we know and the evidence is plenty that chokeholds are not effective. They do not help to restrain, and they do not definitely uphold peace. but most importantly, as a black person, I have seen chokeholds and other uses of force which have taken away the lives of my own relatives and extended family members. And therefore, I am really grateful to see you bringing this bill forward. And I hope that you will expedite it and pass it into a legislation. But I also know that if you do this, it will build trust. It will also show that you are committed as a committee, as legislators, as representatives, in preserving life. But it's also a sign of accountability and a message that you care to those of us who have not only read about but live on a day-to-day basis with police brutality and violence. And therefore, I appreciate you for moving this and urge that it is passed into a legislation. And thank you so much for this opportunity to also speak in support of this bill. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Ms. We now have Jasmine Smith also dialing in from Anchorage. Jasmine, please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you. Oh, awesome. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. My name is Jasmine Smith, and like I stated before, I'm calling in from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a local business owner and community organizer as well. I also wanted to first and foremost thank Senator L.V. Gray for bringing this forward and her staff for all the work they've done on Senate Bill 32. And I think a lot of what I was going to say has been touched on by previous speakers, but I just wanted to echo those sentiments as well in the area of accountability, in the area of trust and rebuilding. There are many other communities and cities and states that have also banned chokeholds in recent years, and I believe that for our community statewide, it would be a great sign of solidarity for especially communities of color and marginalized communities to see that our police forces are, taking those steps to do to work with our communities and those who are in any areas of law enforcement. And again, I just wanted to just say that a lot of what I was going to say has already been stated, but I'm in support of Senate Bill 32, and I hope that this moves forward quickly.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Smith. Are there any questions of Ms. Smith? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next online, we have Liz Light from Fairbanks. Welcome to the committee, Liz.
Hi. I think a lot of people have said a lot of good things in support of this bill. I want to speak in support of it as well. I know youth of color here in Fairbanks that, are traumatized and living in fear, and I think this bill could go a little way in a long way that we need to go, just to know that an encounter with law enforcement is going to result in their death. So I thank you all for bringing this bill forward, and please keep it going. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Liz. Are there questions for Ms. Like? Okay, hearing none. Next, we have Philip Moser from Juneau, who's online. If you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record. Thank you.
Yes. Hello, my name is Philip Moser. I'm calling from Juneau, and I'm representing myself. I'm calling in support of this bill, but I would like to add that I would like to see some significant amendments or additions to it. I think as is, it falls into a bit of a trap where the spirit of the bill is really good, but it doesn't have adequate means to give it teeth. I see that Senator L.V. Gray did include a supplementary article from the CCJ Task Force on Policing. And I do see that a lot of the summary assessment recommendations for such legislation provide a long list of things that help give bills like this adequate means of enforcement. As it is now, and I mean, this is included in this document as well, addressing chokeholds on their own. They are a very small part of an overall epidemic of police brutality, and it's hard to address this by putting out small fire after small fire unless we address the root cause of the issue, which is issues like the subjective nature of what constitutes authorization to use deadly force. So I would like to see some of these assessments and recommendations for such a bill, including things like adequate consequences or written in to the bill, including prohibitions that codify using less deadly alternatives instead of more deadly alternatives. I know that at least for the JPD, that local police department, when this was addressed, the police did say that if such a policy was enacted here, that they would be more likely to use shooting, which is, I don't know, I see that as more of a threat than a warning, personally. But other recommendations like finding ways to add teeth to this would really help. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Moser. Let's see, is there anybody else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 32 by Senator Gray Jackson? It looks like we also have Joseph Kamache, who's the Executive Director for the Police Standards Council, Captain Cornelius Sims from the Alaska State Troopers, both available for questions on the bill. Are there any questions? Senator Clayman.
I think I'd start with Captain Smith or Captain the State Sims. Trooper. Sims, is he on the phone or in the room? On the phone.
Through the chair, this is Captain Sims. I'm available.
Yeah, Captain Sims, what is the trooper's policy with regard to chokeholds? And in that context, the bill talks about the allowance of chokeholds in situations for which deadly force is authorized by law. Can you talk about whether chokeholds are in part of the training and how this exception for where deadly force is allowed would work into that?
Senator Clayman, through the chair, we do the Alaska Department of Public Safety. We do teach carotid restraint, as well as this law with use of force. It is considered can be used only when deadly force would be authorized.
Maybe you could get closer to your microphone or something, because your answer was kind of garbled and hard to follow.
I apologize for that. Through the chair, our policy is for the Department of Public Safety. We do teach it, and our policy is in line with what the legislation is, the bill is. It's authorized only at deadly force.
So can you give me a couple of examples of scenarios that you might confront in the field in which deadly force would be allowed and the trooper would be allowed to use the chokehold? And if you could give a couple of examples when it would be allowed and another example when it would not be allowed.
So through the chair, this is kind of a broad question. In an instance where a trooper or law enforcement officer's life was in danger, or they themselves was, had the threat of being killed, it would be authorized to be used. It would not be authorized just because a person is refusing to, say, exit their vehicle. Obviously, exit their vehicle or refusing to simply comply to the officer's demands of, let's say, putting their hands behind their back.
Follow up. What if the person the officer was trying to arrest was physically fighting back and punching the officer? Would that be enough force being used by the person they're trying to arrest to use the chokehold, or would just punching the officer not be enough to justify the use of deadly force?
Through the chair, that question is it would have to, if the officer could articulate that they felt their life was in danger because of those punches. One can only take so many punches, say, to the head, that they may feel their life is indeed in danger, then they would, you'd be authorized to use deadly force, rather it be a chokehold or some other form of deadly force.
Follow. Senator Clayman.
What about a situation involving somebody that's attacking a third person and the officer intervenes trying to stop an assault? Would the officer in that scenario, are there scenarios there where the officer would be allowed to use deadly force, in this case a chokehold?
I would say, once again, if they can articulate that they believe that that other person's life was in danger, in line with what our law currently allows, if they can articulate they believe that person's life was in danger, a carotid restraint or would be could be articulated to be a reasonable use of force.
Does the Department of Public Safety have a position on Senate Bill 32?
I don't. I would say neutral because it is in line with our policy. So,
okay, thank you. And then I had some questions for the person with the police standard.
Okay, Senator Clayman, there's a question from Senator Clayman to Mr. Joseph Kamache from the Alaska Police Standards Council. If you state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Hello, this is Joseph Gamash for the record with the Alaska Police Standards Council.
Mr. Gamash, did you hear some of the questions I asked Captain Sims?
Through the chair, yes, I did.
So broadly similar questions in terms of the Police Standards Council. Is the language of this bill consistent with the standards that have been adopted by the Police Standards Council?
It is in line and consistent.
Follow-up. Senator Clayman?
So is the approach that chokeholds may be taught in training to be used in situations involving deadly force, that's allowed by the Police Standards Council, but use of those chokeholds is only permitted, or a carotid hold is only permitted in situations in which deadly force is authorized and in no other situation?
Through the chair, the Police Standards Council, basically ours is a more broad overview of the law enforcement agencies throughout the state of Alaska. So that's where they would fall into individual departments' policies.
Does the Police Standards Council have a position with regard to Senate Bill 32?
Yeah, we are neutral.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Clayman. Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also for Mr. Gamash, are there any statistics regarding peace officers using chokeholds?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that whole question.
Do you have any statistics in Alaska regarding peace officers using chokeholds?
To the chair, I do not have those statistics, but I can see if we can find something.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski.
Are you aware of any disciplinary actions that have been taken against peace officers for inappropriately using chokeholds?
Through the chair, I am not aware of any situation involving a chokehold that had risen to the level of any sort of discipline that got to the Police Standards Council.
You want to follow up? Thank you, Mr. Gamash. Are there any other questions of either Trooper Sims or Director Gamash at this point? And are there any comments or questions from the sponsor of the bill or her coworker? Senator Gray Jackson?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, one question for Senator Gray Jackson.
Okay, we have one question. Senator Clayman.
For the Anchorage Police Department, is their policy similar to the trooper policy that they may train the use of a chokehold, but they can only use it in situations in which deadly force is allowed, or is their training no chokeholds at any time?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Clayman, I really don't know. I think that's a question that you may want to ask APD. Thank you.
Great. They're not online.
If, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, yep. If I can follow
Senator Gray Jackson.
Bessie Odom has a comment to make. Thank you.
Yes. Ms. Odom.
For the record, this is Bessie Odom. The answer to your question is no. They do not utilize them.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Odom, and thank you, Senator Clayman. Are there any further questions of the presenters of the bill? If not, we will close public and invited testimony at this time. And that concludes our committee discussion on Senate Bill 32. We will set Senate Bill 32 aside for a future hearing, and we will take a brief at ease to discuss the next bill coming before us.
Thank you.
Call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. We have now a bill presentation from Senator Schauer. We have Senate Bill, I don't have the number in front of me, Senate Bill 31. Thank you. We have Senate Bill 31 before us. We do have a number of folks who've been invited to testify who are online on Teams. And in the room, we also have a number of folks who are here in Juneau to testify and several audience members who've been on since the very beginning. We're going to try and hear as many as we can today, and we will also keep public testimony open on this bill. I also wanted to let you know that testimony can be received by the committee through email at senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. That email address is senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. With that, we have Senator Mike Schauer, District O, if the senator would like to introduce himself and his affiliation for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Mike Schauer, District O, from the greater north part of the Matsu Valley. I do appreciate the committee allowing us to have the chance to come talk to the committee and present this bill, and it's an interesting switch because you and I have obviously worked in state affairs for a number of years together, so on the other side. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, we'll go ahead and go through the sponsor statement, and I would like to just give a brief overview of what happened, if that's okay, as far as the sponsor substitute, so the committee's aware. We had the old version of the bill from the last 2 years was initially given to us back for this new session. And based on the timing and the rules and when we were allowed to come on board or, you know, to do this testimony or this hearing, we got the new version of the bill that we were trying to clean up last night, yesterday. So kind of in a scramble mode now. So what I'm going to do, so I don't waste the committee's time or confuse the public or the committee, I'm going to basically talk through that and just kind of give an overview so people understand where it's at, if that's okay.
Great. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. And I'll start off with a sponsor statement. This is Senate Bill 31. This is an act relating to selection and retention of judicial officers. And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to skip a little bit of this just for time so we can get some of those folks in. I won't go into too much depth. We can talk later if there are questions. Alaska's Constitution is very clear. There are two tiers of judges. We have constitutional judges, Superior Court judges, and Supreme Court that must be vetted by the Judicial Council. And the governor can only select from a list of two or more names submitted to the council. And the operating authority of this provision is Article 4, Section 5. The governor shall fill any vacancy in an office of the Supreme Court Justice or Superior Court Judge by appointing one or two or more persons nominated by the Judicial Council. There is also a second tier of judges, one that the legislature and the Constitutional Convention left to the courts some time ago to the judicial branch, and those are statutory judges. District Appellate and Magistrates, existing statute currently follows the Judicial Council nomination process. However, judicial candidates are subject to the legislation's discretion on how they are selected, appointed, and whether they are confirmed by the legislature. SB 31 exercises the legislator's delegated constitutional authority to set policy on how these statutory judges are selected to serve on the bench. The operating authority for this provision is also Article 4, Section 4. Judges of other courts shall be selected in a manner for terms and with qualifications as prescribed by law. Currently, magistrates serve at the pleasure of the presiding Superior Court judge. Appellate and district court judges are nominated in statute to find process that mirrors the judicial council selection process for Supreme and Superior Court judges. The council is structured to give a majority of the Alaska Bar members the control of who gets to be a judge or justice, the deciding vote, and a tie between the ex officio seventh member of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court between the three lawyers and the three civilian members has happened actually 79 times since 1984. So it is if you were to average it out, it's almost twice a year this actually would happen if you looked in time. Additionally, all candidate names are subject to the bar member controlled pre-screening process. Bar members of the council are appointed internally by the bar with no legislative confirmation or administrative oversight. Virtually all the judiciary branch is beyond the reach of democratic controls. There is no saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're certainly not alleging that there's any corruption in it, only that there is great power consolidated within the judicial branch with very little oversight from the people where the power according to the Constitution is derived from. In a legislative briefing to a joint session of the legislature, Chief Justice Winfrey recently decried the legislature meddling in the judiciary, claiming there are no politics in the judiciary. And if you disagree with that, then you're just a sore loser. He was adamant that people's representatives should not influence the selection of judges.
Chair, I appreciate the presentation from Senator Schauer, but suggesting that Chief Justice Winfrey called anybody a sore loser, I think, is a poor characterization of Chief Justice Winfrey's comments. And I just want to take exception to those comments. I think the Chief Justice comes every year and makes comments to our body that I think are done in an exceptionally respectful manner. And I think we as legislators need to show that same respect to those individuals. And I don't think those comments are consistent with that spirit.
I'll let you all up, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like.
Senator Klayman, Senator Schauer.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. And just for note, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I have sat in this room and had a former Chief Justice make those kinds of comments that interrupted this body from the same point of view. So it has happened before. The constitutional framers sought to protect the upper benches from political meddling against their own convention consultants' warnings, yet the lower benches, they left it up to legislative control and handed it over to the judiciary. Up to this point, the legislature has ceded 100% of its control and mirrors the constitutional Alaska bar selection controls. The Alaska Constitutional Convention Judiciary Committee consultants wrote, as reported by Vic Fisher in his book, The Alaska Constitutional Convention, no state constitution has ever gone this far in placing one of the three branches of the government beyond the reach of democratic controls. We feel that in its desire to preserve the integrity of the courts, the convention has gone farther than is necessary or safe, and putting them in the hands of a private professional group, however public spirited its members may be. Senate Bill 31 strikes the safe constitutional balance envisioned by the framers by giving the governor and the people's representatives an appropriate say in who sits on certain statutory benches. It allows the governor to appoint and the legislature to confirm who fills, in this case, district court and appellate judges. That's one of the changes. It still allows the council to screen and recommend all candidates, but the governor is not mandated to appoint only from the bar submitted list. The governor can submit and nominate and appoint judicial council screening magistrates to the district or appellate courts under this change. Even then, the final safety cross check would be up an up or down vote on each appointment to the lower courts by the legislature, like many other states actually do at this time. And I'm going to stop there just for time, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay. I'd like to do two things. If I could just read through have my chief of staff just read through the change, that would be the new version of a sectional analysis, because we don't have that, if that works for you, or however you'd like to handle that, your will.
So, well, we'll ask the committee. So what we had was we had a sponsor substitute that was not introduced appropriately on the floor. So the bill that we have before us is the bill that was originally pre-filed, I suppose.
There's two here, the original, and then, of course, we have with us the new one, but I can't bring it up yet because I haven't had the chance to have it substituted yet.
And that will be substituted on tomorrow's meeting, probably tomorrow.
As soon as I can.
Okay. So I guess if you could just, sort of high level go through the bill. We'll have a second hearing at some point in time where maybe Naresh can talk about what's in the contents of the bill, the difference between the two.
I can make it real fast.
Okay.
Bottom line is we've stripped out the magistrates.
Okay.
If you were to take the current version of the bill you have in front of you, where it has magistrates for appointment selection, like the district and appellate courts, we stripped that out. And that was from negotiation with the courts based on complexity, cost, time, et cetera. So just strip magistrates out. The only thing that magistrates are in would be in the new version of the bill is just the accountability section. They're added where you have things like the reporting requirements, how they are retired, if they have something to complain against them, et cetera. But they're out of the process. That's it in a nutshell. That's the 60,000-foot view.
Great. Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Pass that.
Mr. Chair, if we have questions for the sponsor or his staff, where do those come in today?
You're right.
Whenever.
Yeah. Okay. It looks like the senator is prepared for questions. Do you have a question, Senator Klayman?
A couple of questions at this point. First, you made reference to 79 times when the Chief Justice voted on whether or not to advance a name or not advance a name to the governor for nomination. How many times was a name advanced and the Chief Justice never participated?
I don't know the exact number. I'd have to look at that.
We're talking hundreds, thousands? Do you have any idea?
It can't be thousands because there's a whopping total of 112 judges in the state, and considering how long they serve, I know it's not that many. It would probably be a few hundred in the state's history at best. So I don't know the exact number.
You're suggesting just a few.
Through the chair, sorry. It's been a while.
You're suggesting just a few hundred times that they've actually advanced a name to the governor without the Chief Justice having to cast a vote to essentially break the tie.
Through the chair, I believe that is correct, Senator Klayman. And this comes from Ledge Research. That's where we got the data from, and it's a long and exhaustive list. So we pulled out the 79 times that the Chief Justice has had to cast a tie-breaking vote. What I did not ask was how many times it's happened in the history of the courts itself.
Senator Klayman, follow up.
Of the 79 that it looks like you did spend some time doing research on, how many times of those 79 did the Chief Justice vote yes and advance the name onto the governor? And how many times did the Chief Justice vote no and not advance the name onto the governor?
I didn't actually, through the chair, sorry, I'm going to get that right. I did not do that, Senator Klayman. The reason is because what will happen here, and I already know it because I went through that the last 2 years, there will be claims of only wanting to do this for political purposes, to insert politics into the judiciary, because that's the feedback we received many times, including from some lawyers and former judges that testified. So what we're looking at was just the number of times it happened, because they said, well, this doesn't happen very often, so we just want to know how many times it happened. I'm trying to avoid looking at, you know, the politics on the left or the right or which way they went with one group or the other, because I only wanted to show that it does happen, because that was a question that had come up. So I hope that makes sense. Why we avoided that particular
Senator
set of data.
Claim and follow up.
Well, I mean, I glanced as fast as I could looking through the packet of materials that you provided, and it looks like what you provided were examples in which the Chief Justice did actually vote yay or nay in terms of advancing a name. And what I observed, and again, I didn't try to keep a tally sheet because it's your bill, but it struck me in looking at them that the substantial majority of the time the Chief Justice vote would vote to advance the name on to the governor rather than not advance the name on to the governor. And in terms of, I don't know, I wouldn't suggest it's a political process. I would suggest if the Chief Justice generally says yes, the council probably knows that. And if they can't, if they have a tie vote, then the Chief Justice, they generally know the Chief Justice is probably going to move the name forward. And I don't see that as a political process at all. But I would be very interested in your office doing the counting and letting us know how many times that Chief Justice voted no from the data you provided and how many that they voted yes.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, or Senator Klayman, through the chair, will absolutely try to get that data. I just didn't bring it for that reason because I was trying to prevent what I knew was going to happen. And Mr. Chairman, a couple more things. I know time is critical for the entire testimony, so I'm going to maybe just hold this off because there's no way I can go through the next, you know, few minutes before we're going to run them out of time. So I would like to present one thing just to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, unfortunately, ripped because I tried to pull it apart. It kind of came apart of my hands here. There's two things here that you can pull out in one of the sponsor statements is the supporting documentation. If you look a couple pages in, and you will see the one that seems simpler is just a straight line down, and that is the current way that we select all of our judges, essentially, with the exception of magistrates, which are under the control of the Superior Court judges. So it's not actually any selection process at all other than a judge doing it when we're removed from the citizens as far as having any input to it. But for the four primary, Supreme, Superior, District, and Appellate, you can see you have an attorney pull, two or more names are referred, you have the Judicial Council screens it, those names are sent to the governor gets to choose from those two names and those two names only, and that's it. But we are suggesting with Senate Bill 31, if you look at it, it's a little bit different. But it's essentially the same process. What it has done, Mr. Chairman, is you have the same attorney pool. The Judicial Council still vets those selections and screens them. The governor then makes a selection. And that's the way it would normally work. And if you read the bill, that's what would happen. If the governor rejects those selections, he basically triggers a second round. And it goes back again. And now what you have is the governor can choose to. The Judicial Council can give him up to four more names. And then the governor would choose from those. That's all we're really doing is expanding the pool at that first part. The second part is you look down further the line that is different than what we do. But many other states do this. And they, frankly, they elect some judges. They appoint some judges. They have legislative approval on some judges. If you look across the country, and in fact, about almost three quarters of the country now does not have this Missouri or merit plan. There's only a few states that are left. We're one of the few left that do this. And then at the end, to start taking back some of our authority and not going to elected judges or other things, we would have legislative confirmation for an up or down vote from us, taking our power back on those judges for just the district court and the appellate courts. And to be clear on the numbers, Mr. Chairman, there's about 112 current judges in the entire state. That's 24 judges. And based on how long they serve, we're not talking about this happening very often. This is a pretty small step compared to the numbers. I just wanted to throw that out because I think it's important people see it. Sometimes the visual is easier to understand than a lot of words on a piece of paper. And I think the numbers are important based on that. And at that point, Mr. Chairman, I will gladly entertain questions, but if I don't stop here, we're going to run the invited testimonies out of time.
A couple more questions for the bill sponsor.
Very well. Senator Klayman.
I take it you agree that right now all judges, not magistrates, but all district superior court, courts of appeals, and Supreme Court judges go through the exact same process for appointment as they all go through the same process for appointment today.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that is correct. I don't concur.
Okay. And follow?
Senator Klayman.
One of the questions I have in looking at your bill is if you acknowledge that the Supreme Court must follow the process that's laid down in the Constitution and that the Supreme Court is really the ultimate authority on the law, on interpreting the law that comes before them. It strikes me that one of the challenges that if you have a different process for some judges but not all judges, that the judges who go through a different process are more likely to not approach things with the same degree of rigor or may not approach the work they do in the same way that the judges that are appointed pursuant to the constitutional process. And so you would actually invite more appellate litigation, more disagreement amongst the district court and the courts of appeals with the superior court and the Supreme Court. And it seems like in terms of the actual process of people getting decisions made by the courts and getting certainty, your process would actually make it worse than it is today. And it's a pretty good system we have today.
Senator Schauer.
This is going to take time, Mr. Chair, so I'll shoot this quickly based on this. But first of all, Senator Klayman, this is what the original consultants to the founders of our Constitution told us to do. This what I'm suggesting, actually even a step further if you go back and read it, not to do what we did here. So there are arguments on both sides, like all things. You're a lawyer. You understand that, you know, this is an opinion. It goes back and forth. But the Supreme Court still sets the rules for all of those courts and how those judges are supposed to operate. So to say a judge would operate differently than that when the Supreme Court sets the rules, I think might be a little bit outside the bounds of what I would expect from them to do their job. If we really expect them to be unbiased and objective, then they're going to follow the rules of the Supreme Court sets. That's all those courts, every single one of them. So I would expect them to follow that regardless of how they were selected. That's very different. And frankly, if you want to talk about how we may have bias induced in that, if you have a Superior Court judge that is selecting the magistrates, which is over one third of our judges serving in the state, it's hard for me to imagine how that judge doesn't in some way owe something to that Superior Court judge. So somebody could use the same argument and say, well, maybe there's some injected bias there because that magistrate owes the Superior Court being selected, because there's no process on that one. The Judicial Council doesn't do that. They're just selected by a single judge, and that judge gets to make that determination. So I don't – that this is, again, an opinion, but I don't see that as a problem, and it's not what the original founders debated on this and how they were going to work it. So I don't see that as an issue.
Senator Klayman.
Can you point to any example in which a magistrate was found to owe some duty of loyalty or some other reason to be like towing the line for a Superior Court judge that may or may not have hired them? I mean, you're talking about this, but can you give me any example of that ever occurring in state history?
Through the chair. Senator Klayman, can I point out a legislator that owes something to a donor? I
mean, this question,
I understand Senator, that, but I'm trying to tell you, you're asking me to prove something that is unprovable, because nobody's going to come out and say, yes, I owe that judge for appointing me. Nobody does that. They're not going to say that. So, and you could use this on any number of things we do. If somebody does something, it's human nature to think that that person may very well owe them. My only point to that is not saying that they do, But it is not an unreasonable assumption to think that if somebody is given something, there may be something as far as a human bias to how they may treat what they do. So that, I know you're not going to agree with that, and that's okay. That's fine.
Senator Klayman, do you have questions?
Doesn't the Commission on Judicial Conduct look at even a magistrate if they were not following the law and instead trying to do something inappropriate?
My understanding, through the chair, my understanding, Senator Klayman, is that if a complaint was filed, because we're putting magistrates under that, then that would happen. But I don't believe that happens right now unless we were to change this, which we added that into the new version of the bill that unfortunately don't have in front of you at the moment. We added them into that.
I've got a lot of questions, but I'll.
It looks like there are more questions of this committee. There are several people who are both online and invited by this committee, as well as a lot of folks who are in the room and online who wish to testify on this bill. What I'd like to do is just go ahead and start with the folks who are online who've been waiting and invited by this committee to testify, and then remind everybody who's either in the room or online that they can testify also at a future meeting, as well as through the emails, through our email at senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. We would appreciate the input from folks. So if the sponsor of the bill is okay, if we can go ahead and just move on and get some folks who are online right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You invited testimony.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Schauer and team. I'll go ahead and just, we have an order in which we were given. The order first, it looks like we have Betty Jo Moore to testify as invited testimony on Senate Bill 31. And I'll go ahead and open up public and invited testimony at this time. And if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record. Thanks for being here.
My name is Betty Jo Moore, resident of Anchorage, representing myself. Alaska needs judicial reform. SB 31 addresses corrections and the selection review process of judges. Not all judges follow the law's constitutional right to due process, a fair trial, best interest of our children and families. The violations of our constitutional rights, laws, compact agreement with some of the 229 tribes, etc., have resulted in judicial corruption throughout many courtrooms and government departments. Our selection of judges should never be controlled by a political party or the Alaska Bar. The people of Alaska need their elected representatives to bring about change to the selection and review of judges. Alaska needs judges who will protect Alaskans against such absurd injustices that many have and are facing. In 2020, Chief Justice Bolger and Justices Winfrey, Masson, and Carney released a statement to fellow Alaskans, quote, "We recognize that too often African Americans, Alaska Natives, and other people of color are not treated with the same dignity and respect as white members of our communities. And we recognize that as community members, lawyers, and especially judicial officers, we must do more to change this reality," end quote. I want to add another group of people who are not treated fairly with the same dignity and respect in our communities, and that is the people who do not have the education and or the financial means or necessary political connections to protect their constitutional rights, their right to a fair trial, and or their right to protect their children from the state's OCS foster care system. What about the individuals who were or are in prison for crimes they did not commit? Did they get a fair trial? Chief Justice Bolger and the justices' statement goes on to read, quote, "And our courts are tasked with putting that principle into action by allowing people to seek redress for their grievances with the assurance that they will be heard and treated fairly," end of quote. Several weeks ago, all senators and representatives were mailed information about the Kenai grand jury investigation regarding Marla Greenstein, Alaska's only judge investigator, about the process and judicial corruption. In the same mailing, you also received letters to Governor Dunleavy, Judge William Morris, and an email to Ms. Greenstein from David Ignall. December 24, 2021, I wrote Chief Justice Winfrey about the wrongful and inaccurate facts in an order that a Superior Court judge wrote. I wrote Attorney General Taylor a letter October 31, 2021, about the imbalance of the judicial system. SCO 1993 is wrong. Chief Justice Winfrey didn't improve changes. He violated our Alaska constitutional right to go before a grand jury. In 1985, the grand jury investigated Governor Sheffield and his staff. Today, each of you and we the people have the documented information to prove that many Alaskan judges are corrupt and need to be impeached. We are not sore losers. We are not town criers. We the people need your full assistance to stop judicial corruption. Corruption breeds corruption. Where does the remedy exist? Our elected representatives need to protect our constitutional rights in the selection of judges. SCO 1993 severed our right to appear before a grand jury. SB 31 needs to become law. Our elected representatives need to call for a special Alaska Constitutional Convention. I want to thank Senator Schauer for SB 31. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Do we have any questions for Ms. Moore, who's online with us today? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What percent of Alaskan judges would you say are corrupt?
Well, I'm not going to give you a percent answer until we go through the documentation. And this is now being, this is what has happened down in Kenai with the grand jury, is this documentation has been, we have the documentation, and yet Marla Greenstein, who's been the Alaska's only judge investigator for, what, approximately 33 years, and she was being investigated. And so I can't give you a percentage, but where there is one instance of a corrupt judge that did not, or an instance where a justice denied us our Alaska constitutional right to appear before a grand jury, that's one too many. Thank you, sir.
Senator Wilkowski, follow up.
Quick follow up. I know we have other witnesses, but there is a process if there are corrupt judges to remove them because they're up for retention vote every several years. Is that correct?
That process doesn't work. When they come up for retention, it goes on and on with people asking questions. I mean, I went out campaigning for an Alaska Constitutional Convention to address judicial reform. And people are like, well, how do we vote? What should we do? They don't even know the names coming up for the justices in their districts. And it takes a lot of education and study to learn about how many cases a judge ruled in error on.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. We will move on next to former member of this body, Senator Lauren Lehman. Welcome. And Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman. If you would enter your name in the record and your affiliation, and we've got a time limit, if you could just adhere to the five-minute time limit. Thank you.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Well, Senator Kawasaki and members of the committee, indeed, I'm Lauren Lehman. I reside in West Anchorage, and I sat on the other side of the table for many years, 14 years actually, in the legislature, and then served the term as lieutenant governor. Great years, and I thank you for your service and what you're doing. And thank you for hearing this legislation today. I think in the to shorten you know, my time, I just want to tell you a quick story about what happened to me when I was a freshman member of the House, and at an At Ease, a very respected member of the House who was in leadership, and he was a Democrat. Those days, things were tough for us Republicans. We were outnumbered in the House 24 to 16. But he came up to me and said, you know, I've been watching you, and I think you're going to be around here for a while. And I said, oh, I took that as a compliment, and we just chit-chatted. And he said, you know, I think that one of these years, you'll probably control the legislature, and then you'll be sitting in more in the driver's seat. And he said, and you'll probably even elect a Republican governor someday. And he said, but we'll always have you in the courts, and because of the way we select judges. And I thought he was being unusually honest, and he was. He was an honest man. We didn't often vote the same way, but he was an honest and decent person. And I observed that, and over the years that I was in office, and even since I was in office, I have observed that. And I think it's fair to say, at least from my perspective, that during the last 35 years, I have seen only one strict constitutionalist on the Supreme Court. You know, and there were a couple others who weren't always there, but they were there sometimes. But other than that, it's pretty much been a very tough court to be on. And I think that by my count, every Republican governor since statehood has complained not so much about the names advanced by the Judicial Council, but because of the names not advanced. And there are qualified people. I can think of several, but two examples. One is Judge McDonald, a Superior Court judge in Fairbanks, and you probably know him, Senator Kawasaki, or know of him. Just highly competent, who was not even advanced by the Judicial Council. And more recently, Judge Paul Ropeman from Kotzebue, who comes in with tremendous credits, and yet the Judicial Council wouldn't even advance his name. So the system that we have now is broken. We need fixes. What Senator Schauer has proposed is, I would say it's a creative approach. And it's one that puts some power back in to the legislature, and I commend it, and I support this legislation. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, for your testimony. Are there any questions of Mr. Lehman? Okay. Seeing none, we now have one more person who's invited testimony and possibly a second. If we could be very quick, we have a Mr. Pettyjohn, if you'd put your name and affiliation on the record. I think that you might be muted. Looks like you're...
Now can you hear me?
There we go. We can. Welcome, Senator.
Okay. Hi, this is Fritz Pettyjohn. I'm was in the legislature in the 1980s. And I've been a member of the Alaska Bar Association for 49 years. When I was a law student in 1971, I was forced to take a course called Law, Lawyers, and Social Change. And they taught us as a potential lawyers that we weren't just supposed to be skilled in the law, but we were supposed to advance social justice. I didn't believe it then, and I don't believe it now. I believe that you want to advance social justice, you should run for the legislature, which is what I did. And I think the idea that judges and justices, part of their job is to advance social justice is anathema. Their job is to interpret the law as written, not to create it. Now, of course, we have a real fight in this country over our Supreme Court justices. There are conservatives who believe in judicial restraint, and there are liberals who believe in judicial activism. In Alaska, we don't really have that kind of a conflict. because the Alaska Bar Association, which controls who gets to be a judge, is overwhelmingly made up of people who took that course I did in 1971 and believed every word of it. They believe judges and the court system is to advance social justice. I think that's backward. I think if you want to advance social justice, run for the legislature, put in legislation and do it the way the founding fathers intended. And I think this bill is a step in the right direction to allow diversity of opinion in the court system, which is not currently there to any appreciable degree. And it belongs there. The people of this country elect presidents in part based on what sort of justices they're going to appoint. And we should do the same with governors. And I think governors who would be elected on a platform of selecting justices and judges who believed in restraining the judicial power, respecting the other branches of government, that's a vote getter. And that really is what should happen in the state of Alaska. And this is a small step in the right direction. Thank you, Senator Shaw, for introducing it. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, other members of the committee, for hearing this bill and hearing my testimony. Thank you.
And thank you, Senator Pettyjohn. Are there any questions for the senator? I wanted to thank the three folks who are online currently. We are past time, and we do plan on adjourning this meeting. I did want to announce, though, again, public testimony, invited testimony will continue to be open. We will take any comments that could be emailed to the committee at senate.state.affairs@akledge.gov. And I know, Ms. Moore, if you had something that you had in writing that you might have been reading off of, if you want to submit that, and we'll make sure that it gets in the permanent record. Wanted to allow the sponsor of the bill, Senator Shower, just one more last word, if there's any comments you'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just wait until the next time we have a second hearing. We can just talk then on the questions and finish up. I know time is short, and thank you for the committee for staying late. I know it's past the 5:00.
Thank you, Senator Shower, and thank you, members, for staying just a little bit over time. Again, the public is invited to submit testimony through our office. We'll make sure that all the members get it, or you can send it through our email system at senate.state.affairs@akledge.gov. We'll keep public testimony open. We will set Senate Bill 32 aside at this moment. We will hold a meeting on Tuesday, February 28th. That's next Tuesday. There will not be a meeting on March 2nd, which would be Thursday of the following week. And just for advance notice, we will probably have a meeting on the 7th to talk about elections bills. And also, we've invited the new director of the Elections Division to come forward and chat with us a little bit about elections issues. So with that, are there any other questions or comments from committee at this time? Okay, with that, I would adjourn the Senate State Affairs Committee at 5:07 p.m. Thank you very much.